I'm a little early, but good morning to everybody. And I'd like to, of course, thank Siv and the other organizers for inviting me to come and tell you a bit about my work on brain tumors. I worked in the area of mathematical modeling in cancer for quite a while, and feels like quite a while at least. I mostly work on these brain tumors known as gliomas, and I'll tell you quite a bit about that today. I've also done some work on prostate cancer and some other related areas, so I find the area fascinating, and I'm delighted that such a meeting like this was organized. So, as you can see, although I'm trained as a mathematician, an applied mathematician, mathematical biologist, whatever you want to call it, I live in the School of Medicine and the Department of Pathology. I'm on faculty there, which is kind of an interesting puzzle. It's truly entertaining to the faculty in general, who are just initially, when I first arrived, they were like, "And you do what now? And you're here why?" And now it's much better. It's, you know, sort of evolved over the last, you know, the first academic year of my position there. It was pretty entertaining because they just had no clue. You know, I had three or four key faculty who were just very excited about this type of stuff, but the rest were just like. But now it's much more exciting, and there's a lot of entertainment, and so there's lots of people I think I'm selling on this, I hope. So, I don't know. We'll see. So let me demonstrate a little bit about what I've done with lots of these people who were highly suspicious at first, but I think are coming around, on brain tumors. I specifically work on a certain type of brain tumors, and they're slightly different than what you typically think of as a tumor. We've talked a lot about these sort of solid tumors that may have a potential for metastasis or similar behaviors, but gliomas are slightly different. They're primary brain tumors in the sense that they always start in the brain. Their cell of origin is the glial or structural cells of the brain. And the thing is that it makes them very interesting and difficult in the fact that there exists no effective treatment for these lesions is related to the fact that the cells are highly motile. So although you kind of think of a bulk solid tumor as a bulk solid tumor with some sort of well-defined edge, or at least at some point during the time scale of its life you expect a well-defined edge, these tumors really don't have this. They really do intercalate between all the cells throughout the entire brain. And so even though you see some bright spot on the imaging, the reality is that the cells are invaded throughout the entire CNS. The other thing that's slightly interesting about these tumors is that they really don't metastasize out of the CNS. So although they are very invasive cells, they don't really show up in the liver. It's extremely rare for metastasis to happen outside the CNS. Some people theorize it's just simply because they're so aggressive they kill a patient too quickly to even notice a metastasis. But there's some evidence to say they just do not escape the boundaries of the central nervous system. Now the sort of best version of these, the lowest low-grade gliomas, have about a 10-year median survival time. They do exactly what the high grades do, they just do it on a much longer time scale. They have a very similar behavior to just multiply everything by 10. There's about a 10-month median survival time for these high-grade glioblastoma tumors. Okay, I'll talk primarily about these high grades, but I have a little bit of work on the low grades also. So as I mentioned, the glioma cells are highly motile, and the resulting tumor growth is very diffuse, and that's, as I said, unlike many other tumors. One of the key characteristics that I'll tell you a bit about is the fact that the cells migrate more quickly in the white matter of the brain than they do in the gray. So for those of you that don't know enough about the brain, I'm here to tell you. The gray matter in the brain is where all the neurons are. So it's the cortex on the outside where the neurons sit, and the deep nuclei where the deep important neurons are. And then the rest is white matter. So it's the long axon tails of the white matter. So besides the cortex and the deep nuclei, everything else is white matter. So the cells migrate very quickly in this white matter, and that results in a funny pattern of growth where, say, a tumor originates in a gray matter location, deep nuclei or somewhere out in the cortex. Their invasion pattern is through these white matter channels, and so they extend long distances, maybe not detectable by imaging, but extend long distances through the white matter to throughout the entire brain. So the goal of what I'll try and present and tell you a bit about today is really to integrate the imaging characteristics that you can obtain for individual clinical patients with what information we have from the pathology, and to really get some information about predicting tumor progression, and to go sort of a step further than what standard histology tells us about these lesions. And really, with this information, can we do something to evaluate current and future treatments, things like surgical resection, radio, and chemotherapies? Can we do a better job and help this problem right here, the fact that there are no effective treatments? So again, here's sort of the model picture of what you think of a tumor. There's the gray matter around the edges here. There's the deep nuclei, and there's a tumor, a primary brain tumor in the deep nuclei. I like showing this picture because this is sort of the image that you would imagine. You know, this is a brain with a lesion here. But the reality is very different. This is about a 1 centimeter slice of an autopsy brain of a glioblastoma. And you notice that the pattern of disturbance associated with this lesion is much more profound than this little isolated nodule that they have sort of crudely displayed here, but also the fact that it's very asymmetric and highly invasive in different orientations. So to really highlight what you're supposed to be identifying on this slide, this is really the lesion. So what we think of as tumors in general is really quite different than the reality in these cases. So with that in mind, I always this will be the one equation I'll show you, which is basically the mathematical model that we've been using. And as you can see, it's a fairly straightforward, pretty basic approach in terms of the rate of change of the tumor cell density is given by a net dispersal, a net proliferation. So this is very much a Fisher set of equations here. And then we have transferation among cell subpopulations. So each individual cell population within these heterogeneous tumors have a given rate of migration of cells and a net, sort of a net capable proliferation of these cells. Those two things interact in an important way that I'll really describe quite a bit about in the next bits of this talk. And since these are heterogeneous populations with potential transformation amongst cell populations over time, it's important to, you know, include this term here, but I really won't talk about this particular step in detail, and I can refer you to some work I've done in the arena of looking at multiple cell subpopulations and more heterogeneity issues. But I think it still continues to surprise me how much I get from such a simple Fisher model. The trickiness here is related to the fact that we're in a very complex 3D architecture in the brain. And that this term here is the term associated with the dispersal of the tumor cells or the migration of the cells is a function of the spatial location. So it's in the gray matter we've got DG, and in the white matter it's DW. And as I mentioned, the cells migrate more quickly in the white matter than they do in the gray, so DW is always going to be larger than DG. But again, the trick is the fact that we've got a very complex three-dimensional architecture. So I won't tell you much more about this transformation among subpopulations. I'll primarily look at this set of equations. And so what does this translate to? And is this sort of a reasonable conclusion of this sort of basic picture that diffuse tumor growth, so we have sort of a diffusion phenomena for the cell migration, and then just a net proliferation of cells. Is that enough to get us anywhere? And it turns out it's really fairly reasonable for these tumors. Here's sort of what a solution to that Fisher equation would look like in one dimension of glioma cell density. I've denoted here that there could be some central hypodensity that I have not modeled separately here, but when I do that, it doesn't really change this behavior on the leading edge, and I'll show you why I think that's important and why it's so far not been necessary. So if you sample throughout the brain in these lesions, you find that this distribution is reasonable. With some central necrosis, there's nice hyperdense lesion. These are H&E stained histology slides of an autopsy brain that I'll show you a little bit more about later in this talk. So this is nice hyperdense lesion at the sort of peak. And then at the invading edge, you've got lower cell density. So notice the change in cell density between these two locations. And then way out the invasive edge, this is in white matter, you've got a very low density invasion, sort of indistinguishable from a normal brain. And then, of course, in the center, you've got this necrosis. So given that picture, the reality is we don't have those biopsies. So we don't have, for every patient, we don't have information at each spatial location throughout the brain. We have only very limited. We'll probably only have, like, one of these or one of these. And you really don't know very, very well for an individual patient where in this distribution the biopsy happened. And the co-registration of coordinates is actually not done very well, although we are changing that a bit by being more involved in the in the operating room. But most information about these patients comes from imaging. On the left here, we've got a typical T1 weighted gadolinium MRI. So gadolinium enhancement is injected into this patient, and then a T1 weighted MRI is obtained. And this basically shows you breakdown of the blood-brain barrier, secondary to angiogenic events. And so you have this bright spot, and we associate that with sort of the bulky portion of the lesion. So if you biopsy within this bright region, you'll find high cell density areas and possibly central necrosis. But that's really basically what you'll find. On the other hand, you have a different kind of MRI, the T2 weighted MRI, that provides a little bit more information. Traditionally, T2 MRIs in the radiology world are associated with what's called edema, so lots of water. We all know that MRIs really target visualization of water molecules. And so this brightness on the T2 MRI is often associated with edema, yet we know when we biopsy in these regions, the bright regions that's not bright on here but is bright over here, we find isolated tumor cells. So with this sort of simple idea, which honestly at the beginning I didn't think would come up with much, I have these sort of two measures of the size of the lesion. I've got the T1 weighted MRI and the T2. And with my picture of my mock-up of what the tumor cell density distribution might look like, what kind of information can I extract from that? So one of the first things you can do is just simulate the case and say, let's assume we have a threshold of detection, that upper line that I showed you in the previous image. Let's introduce, and this is a fully three-dimensional simulation of this lesion, originated at this starred location of white matter. Again, the gray appears gray in this picture. Blue contours are low cell density. Brighter colors are higher cell density. And these are all contours of constant cell density. And this thick black contour that just showed up at about 110 days. Let's do this one more time. This thick black contour is the edge of the lesion detectable by the standard T1 weighted gadolinium MRI. So the problem is that you're looking at this entire time scale, which is very accelerated for this simulation, but it's only 128 days, and it's the last 20 days that we actually see it in the clinic. So the idea is that the first result from this is really that it really takes quite a long time before anything clinical is relevant. So the window in which the patient is being treated is very small compared to the total time scale of what's happening with this lesion, which intuitively makes sense, but to demonstrate it like this has been actually very useful for us. The other bit of information about this is that really much of the invasion has already occurred. Just by the fact that you're not observing this lesion until very late in the total time scale of the progression of the lesion, the extensive invasion is extremely important to target in therapy. But if you're limited by this thick black contour, if you're in the clinic and this is what the information you have, this thick black contour and everything within it, naturally that's going to be what's targeted because that's what you can identify and that's what you can watch grow or shrink. And that it's totally reasonable how that becomes the target of most therapies. But the reality is what needs to be done is something about these cell contours that are long distances away from the high density regions of the lesion. And this is kind of a subtle problem, because how do you track that? How do you track the efficacy of a therapy that, say, doesn't do a single thing to this bright T1 GAD, but does something pretty good to this low cell density cells that have invaded long distances? It's hard to imagine designing a therapy that could actually target these cells, because the blood-brain barrier is so tight. So chemotherapies are very difficult to introduce in these situations. And radiation therapy is also has this problem of not really seeing what you're targeting. So it's a funny argument, and I'll try and clarify a little bit about that in just a moment. So again, let's go back to the information that we have at hand clinically. Here's the, again, T1 GAD MRI, T2 MRI, same slide as I showed you before. But one of the things we know about the general fissure thing is that we should be able to get at least an asymptotic speed of this invading front. So we should have some information about the speed at which this invading front is extending out, and that it relates to the migration of the cells and the net proliferation of the cells. So this velocity, there's a fairly constant velocity that we expect this tumor to be spreading along. So this will be my example of some low-grade gliomas. So the idea would be if that is one of your initial conclusions from the model, that we have sort of a linear progression of the lesion over time, what can we do with that information? And the idea would be then clearly go find some untreated patients, follow them over time, and see what happens. The problem is you don't get high-grade untreated patients. High-grade patients come in, they're immediately treated within 30 days, and then their post-treatment behavior can't really be compared in these particular situations. I'll show you how I've used the modeling to do a little bit of comparisons for that at the end, but right now let's just talk about these untreated cases. So these came from a collaboration with a group in Paris, at the PTA Salpêtrière, and they had followed 27 patients. We actually, it turns out that we have quite a few more when looking through their annals. We have quite a few more than this, but the analysis is still pending. Tracking the average diameter of the full 3D volume of the lesion over time. And so you see that this the tumor originates at completely different sizes. You know, the diagnostic size for these lesions is completely variable. And so since patients had various tumor sizes at the time of diagnosis, a linear mixed model with random intercept was used. And so when you introduce that, these things fall very similarly together along a common line. We published this last year in the Annals of Neurology, and this is really a funny thing, and actually very interesting thing. The fact that many institutions treat low-grade gliomas straight away. The University of Washington is one of those. It's very rare for a low-grade glioma to come up. They're fairly identifiable on an MRI. Patient arrives, and they fairly quickly get at least a biopsy with maybe some radiation therapy, especially if they're in an older age bracket. But it's fairly rare for them to just be followed without any sort of treatment. Whereas this group of patients was fairly rare to locate then, and it was delightful that we found them. And when I go through the annals at the University of Washington, I've recently found a handful of patients that are similar to this that have refused therapy for whatever reason. So the thing that's kind of interesting about this is the fact that low-grade gliomas really aren't treated active, there's a disparity between whether you should treat early, treat late, not treat at all for these particular patients. And this really does say something to the clinicians about the fact that these lesions are progressing. So it was surprising to me the fact that in the clinic it's really not well known whether these lesions grow or not grow. So I started asking all these neuro-oncologists that I was working with in various meetings, well, what do you expect a glioma to do tomorrow? If a patient comes in today, what happens tomorrow? And the typical response was everything from there's absolutely no way to predict to maybe exponential growth, probably random. So it depends on the patient. I had a wide range of answers, but none of them made any sort of coherence. And that was reflected by the therapy assumed at each institution. So the aggressive therapy at, say, the University of Washington goes with the idea that they really are progressing consistently over time. There is a progression of the lesion over time. And although it's a long time scale, you see this is in months, the tumor is actively growing. Whereas at the PTA Salpêtrière in Paris, that opinion was on the other end. Well, they're thinking maybe they're stable enough that until they're clinically unstable, until they've entered the clinical realm of something, some major effects for the patient, that's when we'll start treatment. So it's kind of a funny thing, but this really is one of the first observations that there is not only is there active growth of these lesions over time, but there is a coherence to this entire histological group of patients. So these 27 low-grade patients, at about an average of 2 millimeters per year in radius, grow fairly consistently around this median path. And so this is sort of the model, curve. Well, I've located 4 high-grade untreated gliomas, and we've found that there's about a tenfold difference between those two, which is totally the same as reflected by their survival times. There's about a tenfold difference in survival times. There's about a tenfold difference in the rate in which they're doing their thing. We've recently come across about 7 more of these patients, and I've got in the annals about 6 more in addition to that, so it'll be interesting to see how this comes out in the next year or so. Just to give you a sense of the distribution of these things, these low-grade gliomas were fairly tight. I've actually added another one to this particular distribution where we've got 28 of them now in this set. And the high-grade ones are not as tight. But if you notice that the velocity is about a 50% variation range for the for these lesions, and so far the four little points that I've got so far really do quite cover that range. So it'll be interesting to see how that actually fills out. Yes. They were all at first diagnosis. These were not followed low grades that transformed. Yeah, that's actually an interesting subset of patients from the low grade study. The larger group of patients that we're looking at, there are quite a few transformations in there, and we're going to see if we can find distinguishable about these those patients, because those are, of course, ones that you want to target the soonest. So again, let's go back to our picture, and so far we've just realize the fact that these lesions actually do grow, and oddly enough, that was actually something that was not known. The next thing is, what other information can we get from this imaging? Now, a low-grade glioma only is visible on T2 weighted MRI. A high-grade glioma has significant angiogenic effects, so that there is a gadolinium enhancement on the T1 weighted MRI. So if we've got this distribution of the lesion, and we've got some sort of estimated velocity of the leading edge of the lesion, it turns out that if you take a close look at this analytically, take a close look at this curve, you can get a relationship, and I've drawn it here as a slope for the clinicians, but the reality is everybody and all the mathematicians here know that this isn't just a slope, that you can relate the migration rate, the ratio of the migration rate to the net proliferation of these cells by a nonlinear relationship between the size on T1 GAD and the size on T2. So I've derived this little equation to use as much information as provided by our imaging. Well, with that information, we can, if we have an estimate of velocity, so we have two time points that tell us something about how quickly these lesions are progressing, and then we have a relative contribution of these two parameters, then we have individual measures of D and rho for each patient. So we have some measure of how quickly the cells are migrating for the patient in general, and then how quickly the cells are proliferating. And then if you go in and introduce a new therapy that's targeting one or both of these pathways, you can have direct measurement of that effect in vivo. And I think that's a pretty novel utility of this stuff, but I'll be happy to hear your thoughts after the end of this. So we have one great untreated glioblastoma, 75-year-old female presenting with a complex partial seizure. And this was her scan on that day. This is a T2 weighted, it's actually a flare image, but it's in the T2 weighted regime. She refused advice to receive biopsy for diagnosis and treatments, but was happy to accept multiple MRIs. So over the matter of her almost exactly 12-month survival, she had four MRIs and a CT scan. So this is the diagnostic exam on September 2000. This is that low cell density invasion. So this would be on the distribution, this would be the lower of the two lines. And in the matter of 9 months, it grew from this to this. So it's pretty aggressive. This gives you a real sense of how aggressive these lesions are and how quickly they do their thing. The thing that's kind of interesting here is this patient achieved more than her median survival time predicted by having radiation therapy and resection and chemotherapies. So she is an interesting case in that situation. So given the information that I've told you so far, let's just plot up what she has. So here's on this x-axis, we've got the day since diagnosis. On the y-axis on the left side, we've got the size on the two types of MRI, the T1 GAD and the flare, which is like a T2. So I've just plotted the first two time points, because that's all I need to use to generate a velocity, 14 millimeters per year, just fit a straight line through those two points, and then using the flare and the T1 GAD, I can get that ratio D over rho, and so now I have an estimate of D and rho for this individual patient. The red curve up here shows you the performance score for this patient, tells you the amount of clinically relevant impact on the patient. The easiest way to describe it is her neurological deficit is a sort of a general way of describing it. 100 is basically she has no effect. At this date, she came in with a complex partial seizure, but she had no long-term effects afterwards. She could care for herself, etc. At the point of, say, 40, you're not caring for yourself at all anymore, and you're pretty much bedbound at this point. So the idea is I've just put these dotted lines through here saying, okay, there's two observations. I can fit a straight line through that because I expect a sort of a linear progression of this lesion with a velocity of 2 squared to d rho. And I can estimate d over rho from this first time point observation. So I've got these estimates. But does this curve actually make any sense? And when you put in the other points, it actually does. So here's the progression of the lesion on the T1-weighted gadolinium MRI. Here's the progression on the flare MRI. And it's totally consistent with what we expected. And you'll notice that this patient had a sort of a precipitous decline right before her last MRI in the matter of just a couple weeks from perfectly sort of a perfect Karnofsky score to death at almost exactly 357 days. So you'll see that from the first two observation time points with measurable difference between these points, the predicted path is as expected. So this is sort of novel to say that we can, from the first two observations of an individual case, we can make some predictions about where we expect the lesion to go. Now this is on the macroscopic scale. This is telling us just how big is the lesion going to get over time. But we have all this nice spatial-temporal model, so we want to go back and say, well, what can we tell about the pattern of invasion? And how can that, we can ultimately use that information to say something about treatment. So in this left panel here, this is the MRI in the three standard planes. So this is the coronal section, and this is the axial section, and this is the sagittal section, so cut this way. And so this is the same tumor, just cut into three different planes. This is a T1-weighted gadolinium-enhanced MRI, and this is sort of the comparison in the simulation regime. This thick black contour is, again, correlated with this T1-GAD MRI. These blue contours are not visible on the T1-GAD, and the T2 would come here out into this pink regime, and that would be about the extent of the T2 MRI in this case, or a flare. So there's quite a extensive invasion predicted by the mathematical model. The problem is you can't just go in and sample here and here and here if you want to. It's a darn shame, but we can't do that. Which I'm sure the patients are delighted not to have to be involved in this. But in this particular patient, she came to autopsy. So in the end, we have the full spatial distribution, project forward the simulation to a later time point, and then do an overlay of these two things. And so at similar levels in the brain, here's the sort of reference brain that I've been using all along, here's the autopsy of this patient, and there's the overlay of these two things. And what we're doing now, and what one of my students in my lab has just finished, is sort of a tracking of the throughout the entire brain, of this tumor cell, of the total cell density throughout the brain, correlating with gray matter, white matter, where the tumor is, and you notice there's some necrosis, and the fact that there's a midline is this low point here. There's a hole. And then white matter, gray matter, white, and gray. Now, the thing that's interesting about this, I've actually also developed a collaboration related to doing this type of work on other autopsy brains, because to sort of have a map of spatial distribution of these lesions and compare it to the model-predicted sort of, spatial distributions. And what we're doing is much more detailed, where you take the entire brain and you calculate in actually three dimensions with this high-throughput sort of imaging technique where you can calculate cell density throughout the large sections of the brain. So right now we're looking at doing direct comparisons for this case because we had serial MRIs and autopsy of this patient, but there will be other patients with sort of more detailed distributions, which I'm pretty excited about. The thing that's kind of also a little bit interesting about this picture is the secondary sort of growth in the at the gray-white matter junction. So this is one of these things that is kind of nice to study, and we're interested in how the fact that the leading edge of the tumor migrates, the cells migrate very quickly through the white matter, but they encounter the gray matter, which is a slower substrate. So they slow down, and there's a secondary buildup as a result. So it's kind of an interesting observation, and we're looking to see how we can use data like this to add what is never add what is ever ne- whatever is necessary to the model and validate the model further. Now, I told you a lot about untreated patients, but the great majority of patients are treated, and I have tons of data. I continue to be involved in all sorts of studies related to treated patients, but it brings home a different problem of what do you do with this information, and is there any information that we can extract from these studies? I've been involved with several new studies where I've been trying to obtain a sort of optimal amount of information so that we can input it into the model and then sort of prospectively see what's going on. But this is a retrospective study of 70 high-grade gliomas. They were all glioblastomas treated with radiation therapy following either simply biopsy, subtotal resection, or gross total resection. Now, they were split about equally between this group, biopsy, subtotal, which are the blue stars here, and gross total resection. In general, functionally, in patients, the difference between patients treated with just simply biopsy and those treated with a subtotal resection, they essentially do it's practically the same. There's been very few studies that have shown a measurable difference between how these patients behave in general. There's generally a difference between gross total resection and these sort of smaller resection things. So the idea was to use just the diagnostic MRI. What information can I provide from just the simple diagnostic MRI, which is available for these individual patients, to predict future behavior? No velocity information, just the diagnostic MRI. So here's a plot of the T2 weighted MRI size in terms of average radius versus the T1 weighted MRI average radius. You'll see the red boxes again are the gross total resection patients, and the starred boxes are the starred locations are the biopsy subtotal resection. Now the original goal of this study was retrospectively obtained following sort of the surgeon's treatment of patients over a long period of time. And so his goal was, I think, to distinguish was his gross total resection better than Joe Schmo's gross total resection down the street, or you know, similar sort of surgical questions. And the thing that's kind of interesting about this is if you can, I'm going to give you the answer before I tell you the answer again, but from a different way. If you notice the picture, there's quite a bias towards the number of patients that are small lesions receiving gross total resection compared to those receiving biopsy and subtotal up here. So this is kind of an interesting thing that led to a significant difference in survival between these biopsy patients and the subtotal biopsy subtotal patients and the gross total resection patients. And we'll sort of tease out this information in a slightly different way using the modeling in just a moment. So here's the curve. What we did was we took the size on MRI, T1 weighted GAD and T2 weighted MRIs, their average radii by doing 3D volumetrics and then extracting out an average radius. We extracted D over rho. Now, we assumed an average velocity for these patients related to the fact that we estimated a doubling time of about 60 days typical for these cells, so a rho related to 60 days. And that gave us a velocity. And then on average, we assumed a death at 6 centimeters. And this is totally an average that is definitely well-founded in the literature. The problem is this range. There's a huge range around this 6 centimeters. So I wasn't really sure that this was going to come up with anything, and I'm always surprised when I continually surprised when I present this. So on this x-axis we have survival time in weeks. On the y-axis we have percent survivors. So it's standard survival curve. The blue boxes is the model predicted survival given this information, and the starred locations are the actual data. So you can see a really strong close correlation between these patients. So there's quite a good correlation between the model predicted behavior just from the diagnostic MRI and the observed behavior. Now, so these are just the biopsy and subtotal resection patients. So I've assumed no effect for essentially any of the therapy. Which is not exactly surprising considering how minimal the therapies are actually in terms of actually functioning in individual patients. It's very rare to see significant regression on a patient's MRI, at least in my tumor board that I go to every week. These are really, really nasty lesions. Now, we can also look at the gross total resection patients, and I'll show you how I do gross total resection in the next slide, but I thought it was better to show you these results first. So here's the gross total resection curve. This is the real data. Do a similar thing to before where I've got, let's assume that there's no treatment effect associated with, treated as if the biopsy subtotal patients, just like I treated the slide before. Calculate my average velocity the same way, calculate time to death the same way, and there's sort of the lower bound curve. So if gross total resection had no efficacy at all, that would be what I would expect. Now, let's introduce the fact that there is probably a virtual resection at this time. So calculate the rho over d, and then at this step, introduce a virtual resection. Go in and actually calculate a resection, and then continue the simulation. So the problem is a gross total resection simply means that the T1 weighted gadolinium part of the MRI is gone. So that's all we have. 48 hours later, it's still not, there's no enhancement on that MRI. So the surgeon comes in and could take out just exactly perfectly 100% of what's the T1 GAD MRI, or could take out a little bit more. Couldn't do less because then there would be residual and it would be a subtotal resection. So in this case, we can have a minimal gross total resection would be just resecting exactly the T1 weighted radius. And a maximal one would be something like 25% more. Would be rare, but it would be considered extensive. 25% more than whatever that size was. So you can see that I don't have another slide there. You can see that there's quite a close correlation with the actual survival for these patients and that predicted by the model, because the model would really predict that it's somewhere between the circles and the diamonds, sort of minimal resection and maximal resection. The thing that's interesting about this is that that size bias I was pointing out earlier is brought back here. So this curve, this model curve here for biopsy subtotal resection, has a median survival time of like 50 weeks. Whereas if you notice on the previous slide, it's like 35 weeks. So the observed difference that would be come out from standard studies, because these are heterogeneous groups of patients with different biases, doesn't bring this out. So the original observations of just plotting the survival times separately for the group of raw data, the biopsy subtotal group and the gross total group, would show like a 20-week difference for these patients, whereas we're only finding something on the order of 5 to 7 weeks difference as a result of introducing the extensive resection. When you take into account the fact that you can generate this curve, which is what I would term a internal control for the study. It's sort of what would you expect the behavior to be if there was no treatment? And so that's one of the nice things I think about the model is, or this type of technique in general, is to introduce internal controls for studies, where you have sort of patients serve as their own control within a study, and therefore you're not making comparisons between two disparate groups, this group here, that were generally smaller lesions, with the other study, which were generally larger lesions. So you've got you can take advantage of this information and sort of tease out the differences a little bit more. Okay, so let's move on to the next thing. Now, I just sort of swung past this whole idea that I do some virtual resection, so I thought I'd show you a simulation. This is sort of like the most optimistic tumor you can dream of. It's a very frontal polar lesion, so we can go in and we can resect out quite a lot, not we, but they, can go and resect out as much as they, really quite far. You can sort of get back to in this region here. And it's on the non-dominant side in general. So we can do a resection of this lesion, and there it is. So we introduce lobectomy, and we just lop things off. And it's so much fun to do this in the computer. I'm harrowed by the folks that do this in real life. It's not quite my thing. But what you'll see is that thick black contour that was on there was, you know, way out at the pole. It was just, you know, it was here. This thing was a half centimeter in radius, 1 centimeter in diameter, very optimistic lesion. And there's quite a long delay between you lop off this entire frontal lobe and recurrence of the lesion. So this is totally typical of what you would see in the clinic, where you have an extensive resection of the case, totally obliterating any appearance of the lesion on the MRI, and then this recurrence is really quite delayed, but it's very aggressive when it does show up. So this thick black contour again is sort of this edge of the T1 GAD as shown on MRI. When I first started studying these cases, I thought it was fascinating. Looking through some of the literature talking about these extensive resections, and you would go in and you would have cases of these poor children that would have these lesions, and they would do entire hemispherectomies, they would do major surgeries on these patients, and then there would be sort of this delayed recurrence of the lesion, you know, and it would be maybe further away, maybe it wouldn't be right at this edge here, but it would show up here. And then it would be said, there would be remarks like, it's a very unlucky patient to end up with a second tumor. When the reality was that even though the knowledge is completely there that the cells migrate and they're more extensive than what is seen, and you really never do get a gross total resection, the idea of bringing that framework into a, I think, visualization really does help, and really, I think, gets the, at least to my experience, the neurosurgeons interested and excited, and the neuro-oncologists interested and excited, sort of explaining what they see in the clinic. But sort of that concept, that feeling that this is heterogeneous and there's absolutely no way of predicting these lesions, although we know these four or five things about these lesions, these four or five key behaviors of these lesions, bringing that together in some sort of little formalism so that you can demonstrate this integration, I think is a really nice thing to sort of validate what they're thinking and go beyond what I think Philip was talking about in terms of the linear thinking about modeling is really about intuition doesn't always give you the right answer. So intuition says that I went out and I took a major portion of this brain out and the lesion was well far away, and so there should be no recurrence, and yet there's a recurrence at some location peripheral. So the feeling from, I think, the surgical perspective would be that, well, then this recurrence is, you know, there's nothing I could have done, and this was totally a separate lesion. Whereas, and that's sort of, I think, a linear thinking thing where you introduce something like this and you can really describe how this recurrence can happen. And I found that fairly powerful in these sort of visualizations. Now, I talked about virtual controls in these groups of patients, but let's talk about individually. So I've got a small set of patients that actually do have these two time point observations. So I was telling you about having a velocity in addition to sort of what is the spatial distribution of my lesion, the D over rho concept, the sort of slope. So we do have a case, several cases now. This is just an example of one of them, in which we have T1 and T2 sizes of the lesion at two observations before they receive their first therapy. This is typical if a patient is seen from an outside hospital and takes a while to come and shop around at maybe other hospitals to decide which surgeon they like or what therapy they agree with, or just any of these things. You can imagine there's several situations. So when you go in and you search again, you can really find quite a handful of these things, these particular cases. So in this case, we've got a size on MRI for the two time points. So there's my little straight line there with a velocity of about 27.5 millimeters per year. So again, this is a glioblastoma, one of the really quickly growing ones. And using those two things, I should have given you here D and rho, but I didn't, because I have the T1 and the T2 measurements. So I have the contour, the shape of the contour, the D over rho measure, and then I've got a velocity, that 2 squared of D rho. So I can estimate D and rho for this individual patient. And I was talking about earlier how the subtotal resection and the biopsy patients essentially behave the same. So what can we just assume that there's sort of essentially no massive effect of subtotal resection in this case? There's lots of reasons why we think that there are probably auxiliary effects related to release of injury signals into the brain, and that could recruit cells back. And we're sort of exploring that, and this was our first steps towards exploring these questions about what happens to the brain after resection. So you have this, assuming you just have this information, get the subtotal resection and the lesion is here. Well, I attach this slope here to there. So this is the same line, it's just translated over to a smaller lesion because there was a subtotal resection at this point. So this is the model predicted behavior if the tumor was untreated. But of course the patient gets treatment. So you introduce this treatment, you've got, in this case it's standard 6-week radiation therapy, and during the entire time the patient actually also received a chemotherapy called temozolomide. And the thing that was interesting is there's a consistent decline of velocity of behavior of the lesion during treatment, which is interesting. From the clinical perspective, since this is never plotted out, you don't really plot these things over time, it's the tumor is still growing, so this would be considered automatically a failure. Well, we've been able to quantify the level of which things are growing. Still, it's failing. It's quantifying failure, which is probably not the best thing in the world. But we're moving forward here. So again, we've attached this slope here, which is 27.5 millimeters per year velocity. And then as soon as chemotherapy and radiation therapy start, there's a change in behavior. And then there's no treatment after this point, and we're actually getting other observations of this patient. There's actually still a lot. So this last time point is that's when the therapy ends. And so if we've got this observation, which is there's no treatment in this range, I just attached the slope here, this 27.5 millimeters. I took the point and I drew it forward and backwards. And so if you draw that line back, you know, to wherever it would end up down here, it doesn't really matter. And you project this one forward. The thing that was interesting was that it fell exactly where you would expect it to fall. The tumor behaved as if it was returning right back to its behavior that was predicted beforehand, and there was just simply a change in behavior during the treatment, probably associated with a decrease in Rho in the net proliferation of the cells, because these particular therapies, of course, target that primarily. But because we have multiple observations of this information over time, we actually have T2 observations of this patient over time, and we have that D over Rho measurements, we can estimate what the effect was of this individual therapy at these individual time points on the individual parameters, on Rho and D. So this is the in vivo measurements of behavior over time. So I think I can come to my conclusion now, which is, given a pretreatment slope, like in the last picture, so those two MRIs right before treatment, with sufficient time between them to measure difference. And in the case of high-grade gliomas, that's maybe 3 weeks, which is totally common to have, where a patient comes in and, say, only gets a biopsy. Patient comes into the clinic, takes a week or so for the patient to get scheduled for the biopsy, another 2 weeks of recovery before they start their radiation therapy or any radiation planning that happens. That three-week interval is fairly consistent and fairly common. So we're developing a new protocol now to make sure that an extra MRI is introduced at the time point right before radiation therapy starts, so that we can do this on masses of patients instead of digging through files and retrospectively to dig up patients that are similar. So given the pretreatment slope or two MRIs, the model can provide prove the effectiveness of any treatment in terms of net proliferation and migration rates. Because if I've got a slope and I've got from the two MRIs, and then I've got the sort of cell density distribution slope from the D over Rho measure, I can separate out these effects over time. And in this sense, as I was saying earlier, patients can really serve as their own controls. And although this is a model, all models are much less complicated than the reality, that are related to just two major key parameters in the model of net proliferation and net dispersal. The reality is that any number of all these molecular genetic mechanisms that are actively studied really fundamentally are being targeted based on their ability to modulate one or both of these parameters. So having a model in this way seems to work actually fairly well as a stepping point towards getting to how can we introduce new therapies based on molecular genetic mechanisms. And so what the idea is and things that are developing on the forefront for me are things like looking at new chemotherapies that target a specific pathway, introducing a model for that pathway or some information we have about that, how it modulates proliferation, say, or migration, introducing that into the model and then really testing this in vivo and how we can use the model to quantify what we expect to observe for these patients using these new therapies. So the model, I think, has altered longstanding notions that gliomas are unpredictable. At least I hope that's what I've gotten across here. Modeling has really suggested new ways to study gliomas in the fact of appropriately timing serial scans to allow for this calculation of D over Rho, the study I was just telling you about. Really, in vitro and in vivo studies of proliferation and invasion are now quantifiable. There's many different studies out there that look at invasion of glioma cells in various in vitro circumstances, but there's been no language to really quantify what that is. So every study does it in a different way and has no sort of uniform coherence. You really can't compare very well between the studies. At least that's been my experience. So I think this really does provide a way to make some leaps in this area. And the other thing is that by controlling for variations in size at diagnosis, that really is possible in the sense that patients can serve as their own controls. You're naturally controlling for the fact that there's variation in the size. And the effect of individual treatments can be quantified and separated from averages of group responses. And this is related to this point before. And I think I've demonstrated that I think the model is predictive of both population dynamics, so the fact that the survival curves do so well in terms of comparison, and individual growth dynamics. But there's much more work to be done, and that's what I'm doing, I hope. So the next steps, there's lots more information than just what an MRI provides. there's lots more imaging information, for instance, in vivo. One of the other things I'm working on is looking at spatial-temporal tracer dynamics in PET, specifically looking at measures of proliferation and hypoxia. So you can get PET tracers of like C11 or fluorothymidine and C11 labeled acetate, which are injected into patients, and they're targeting certain proliferation pathways, specifically thymidines known to be involved in DNA biosynthesis and acetates involved in membrane biosynthesis. So you can get quantitative measures from single imaging observation of the rate at which thymidine is the rate of uptake of thymidine and the rate of uptake of acetate. And those things can be translated to proliferation rates of cells. And so we want to use this information, and we're working on how to do some translation of this information into that row in our model. And similarly, hypoxia is another one of these spatial temporal things that I think can really be elucidated by a model like this. We have some tracers that map hypoxia in the brain and related to the location of the lesion. And so you have these beautiful three-dimensional maps of where the lesion is, where the brain is hypoxic, and therefore chemotherapy is not going to work very well, and specifically radiation therapy is not going to work very well in those regions. So if we can sort of bring that information into the mathematical model and translate, bring those bits of information together and incorporate that, I think there's quite a lot of interest in here to use this information to then work with radiation therapies a little bit more and really redefine how radiation therapy might be approached. The other thing is that really to further these ideas is we're actively incorporating spatial modeling data into the UW radiation planning system. We have an in-house radiation planning system that was developed by a collaborator of mine. And we are working on using the spatial temporal information that we have about the lesion and incorporating it into how the radiation planning might be done. And we'll see where that actually heads. And then, of course, we're looking at studying many patients following various extensive treatment, and I think I mentioned that quite a bit throughout. Of course, I have to acknowledge all the collaborators. There's quite a group of us at the University of Washington working on this, and then the group in Paris that I was referring to with this low-grade data. Christophe in Créteil, he is involved in this autopsy work that I was telling you about, and the UCLA group is involved in some of the two MRI patients. Two MRIs before treatment starts. The problem is, of course, there's just so many, so few patients in each institution that you really have to go search the world to find as many patients as you can that have that sort of unique characteristic. And of course, I have to acknowledge my funding for this. So I've got some funding from the Dana Foundation Brain and Immunoimaging Program, and sort of an endowed professorship in neuropathology, and another fund at the University of Washington.